shores of El Pacifico, Phil Henry.
Tonight, we are putting aside all of the things that we do on this radio show to entertain, to enthuse, to attract, to distract. We're putting aside all of it. We're putting aside the funny voices. We're putting aside the funny bits. We're putting aside the theater. We're putting all of that aside. We're opening up the phone lines. And maybe we'll take calls and maybe we won't. Because what I've learned, and I've learned a lot doing talk radio, phone calls are simply a tool. Nothing more than that. But I am not going to do any of those things. Tonight I'm just going to sit here for 3 hours and do what I've always believed spoken word talk radio should be, which is essentially storytelling. Compelling people with a story. Compelling people with talking. Okay? There's no rule that says I got to take phone calls, and there's no offense to the people that call talk shows, but phone calls are 9 times out of 10 they're a snooze. And I've got a little rule that I go by. So I can bomb on my own. I don't need help from the audience, you know. But my audience is really not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about that aspect of the audience, however small it is, people that call talk shows. I'm not going to take any extraneous, unnecessary calls tonight, but we might take a few. But the rest of what we have done on the Phil Henry Show over the course of 20-plus years, a kind of radio theater that we invented, we're not going to do tonight. I'm not going to do it tonight because I'm not in the mood, to be honest with you. I'm just not in the mood to do it. It's very, very difficult to do. It's hard work. It is a obvious physical strain because you're doing 3, 4, 5 different character voices a night, and you can lose your voice pretty fast. It takes a lot of preparation, and certainly you expect a certain payoff when you're working that hard. And, you know, our industry, the radio industry, is a very, very limited industry in its ability to deliver reward for that kind of work. So not that I'm not going to do that show anymore, but tonight is not the night. Tonight is not the night. Tonight, we will weave tales, tell stories, lie through our teeth. We will create our show tonight out of a different kind of a material. Perhaps the substance of my life, the substance and the materials that one can draw from the contemporary scene, things that one might draw from history, things that one might draw from, well, the future. I'm going to bring all of that in tonight because that's what I feel like doing, you know? And truth be told, we're probably long overdue for a good, honest, heart-to-heart here between you and me. Now, a lot of you guys have been listening to me for 20 years. A lot of you guys have been listening to me for 5 seconds. A lot of you guys have been listening for a couple of weeks. Some of you came on board a few months ago. Who knows when? Who knows how? It's not important. It's that you are deserving. Every single night you turn on that radio, you are deserving of something that may give you a little bit of a surprise or perhaps something that'll entertain, something that's going to delight or shock. I get it. I understand. You're not here necessarily to be informed, although that's fun. You're not necessarily here to laugh, although that can be a lot of fun too. You're not necessarily here for anything that you really expect that you're here for. You're just here to be interested, to be enticed, to be drawn in, to be stimulated, there's a word, for as long as I can possibly do that, and then you're going to go someplace else, and I don't blame you at all, man. But I'm just going to do my thing tonight on a Monday night here in America, Monday night, Tuesday morning, sans all of the other theatrics that I have often brought to the radio. Because I'm just not in the mood. I like it. I like doing that kind of show. I mean, but I'd tell you something right now. I'd love to make a really happening big time living just talking politics, but that stuff isn't interesting to me either. What is interesting to me, though, is people. People have always fascinated me, and sometimes I've been, as you have been, I've been both repelled and attracted by the human animal, you know. Sometimes people do things that are heroic and amazing, and you can't stop talking about it, and sometimes people can be so repugnant. And I'm not talking about criminals. I'm not talking about people that harm other human beings, violent people. No, that's obvious. No, I'm talking about just the daily... just sort of the daily parade of dumb, you know, that sometimes you see. It can't, you know, it just, it knows no bounds sometimes. So people are really fascinating to me in all of their regalia. And that's what we've always done our show about, human beings and people's reaction to things. I don't really care as much as perhaps some people think I should. And I don't think you do either. You know, I don't think you really care as much as some people think that you do about who is going to be the president. Yeah, it's an important decision. There's no question about that. But, hey, how much of that stuff are we going to talk about before you? Well, look, I know who I'm going to vote for. And I'd like to hear some different opinions. All right. So you got a million different opinions on who you'd like to vote for. Pretty soon, all it is just a big screaming match, isn't it? Now, what I like is I like to dig into the human condition as to why we are the way we are. Why do we do this, for instance? Why do we always do this? Why do we always say, when a guy says, well, you know, your guy mounted a giraffe in full view of people and had sexual relations. Yeah, well, your guy did it with a mule. Now, why do we do that? And the reason why I bring that up is, every time somebody indicts something that we believe by bringing up an odious, nefarious aspect to it, we don't respond by explaining that act. We go down to the same level and we say, well, maybe my guy mounted a giraffe, but your guy was all over a mule the other day in the city center. And there's where the argument goes. Why is that? I'll tell you why. Because we don't really know why we believe what we believe. All we know is we belong to a club, man, you know. I'm in this club, you're in that club, and, well, okay, why are you in that club? Well, why are you in that club? You know, how many arguments have you ever been in, or how many debates have you ever heard where it goes there? Why are you in that club? Well, why are you? Like the other day, and I don't want to get political, this is not what this is about, but the other day I was saying something along the lines of, I was talking to somebody who said, you know, they're saying Bradley Manning is a hero. This is this guy, army guy that leaked all the information, you know, the WikiLeaks guy. Now he's in jail. He's an army guy that leaked information that was top secret or was privileged communication. I don't know. Call me crazy. Shouldn't a guy like that be arrested? Well, according to some people, no, he shouldn't. And the fact that Obama arrested him was hypocrisy. And I said to the guy, wait a second, he's the president of the United States. Isn't he supposed to, you know, enforce the law? Yeah, well, was he enforcing the law when we selectively, go after international? So in other words, what the guy was trying to do is draw me into some debate about how Obama is actually a hypocrite. He doesn't really enforce the law because he doesn't necessarily, adhere to international law. There was not any argument as to why the guy believed, you know, as to the necessity. The guy broke the law, man. So why are people dumb like that? And I've only come up with this conclusion. The reason why people go to those arguments is because they belong to a club. This is the club they're always going to be belonging to. And even if they have to retreat to this just abject stupidity, they're going to belong to that club. And that club is, in this guy's case, it was neither Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative. He was part of, I mean, I can tell, man, right away. This dude was part of that I don't want to say ever burgeoning, but it's a group of people that are like the truthers. You know, everything, there's something going on, man. They don't know what it is, but there's something going on. Something going on. you know, there's, are you believing in a trilateral command? I don't know. You know, these guys have been with us for a long time since the Russian secret police wrote the trilateral code, that book, you know, about the, oh, the Elders of Zion. Have you heard of that one? That's the one that fueled the whole Jews run the world thing. It was written by the Russian secret police. It's a complete trumped up hoax. And yet it lasts and people quote it. Now, do they know they're quoting a hoax? Maybe. Maybe they do. Then why would they adhere to it, Phil? Why would they embrace it? Because that's the club they've decided to belong to. That's what they want to push. They want to push all that Jews created all the problems, and they're going to push it regardless, man. That's what they want to do. So it's no longer a belief as to what will make the world better. It's a country club of some sort, or it's a private society of some sort, or it's a secret society of some sort. It is belonging to something. Even if it's something that's going to take you right straight down the toilet, you know? So you can believe that Obama's part of an international conspiracy. You can think that the Mormons are a bunch of weird asses. You can think this, that. You can be Republican. I don't think Republicans and Democrats are any different. I think they're all part of the same mentality, which is I want to belong to a big family. Even if I got to be stupid, that's what I want to do. That's, you know, if you want my honest opinion about it. But this isn't about politics. This is about other decisions. Why do we send our kids to the schools we send them to? And why do we become members of the same neighborhoods? And why do we wear the same clothes, things like that? You know, I mean, that's what's interesting to me about people. We sacrifice, for instance, why do we risk death in order to have sex? Why do we do that? You know that people will risk AIDS, unprotected sex. They know they're going to get a death penalty, possibly, just to have sex. Why? Because some stuff is really important. And it's more important to belong than it is to advance truth. And it's more important to have sex than it is to live. Oh, well, that's ridiculous, Phil. That's what I'm seeing around me every day, man. You can say it's ridiculous. That's exactly what's happening. All right, I better take a break. And we will be right back on the world-famous Phil Henry Show. And what comes on the other side of this break, I cannot be, I don't want to take responsibility. I have to take responsibility for it, but I cannot tell you what's going to happen.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show. You're listening to the world famous Phil Hendry Show.
Welcome back here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. If you're just joining us, I am dispensing tonight with our usual theatrics. We're dispensing tonight with the usual theatrical affectations. And I know that there's people would say, well, wow, Phil, you know, do you think the comics of the day, the people that do their TV shows, the people that do their performance on stage, do you think they do that? Well, I don't know if they do or not. I don't really care, but I do a three-hour radio show. That's different from doing a half an hour of television. It's different doing an hour of television once a week. This is, or even if it's every night, it's much different. This is a radio show that's 3 hours long nightly, and it requires these moments, shall we say, of distraction, and they require that we sometimes just take a, you know, big left turn or a right turn and go off road for a while. That's what it's about. And I was also inspired to do this because as I look here on Phil TV in HD, I have a series of slides behind me on our green screen that look as if were I the founder of a religion, and I wanted myself to be the god of that religion. These slides behind me are exactly what I would hang in my church. I'm kidding, but sort of not. Sort of not. All right, so if you're just joining us, here's where we're at. This is where we're at. I'm trying to find out now, what do people really believe? Because if there's one thing that talk radio, and really what is this about? My whole life has been, my whole professional life for the last 22 years has been about deconstructing and making fun of things in the media And one of the things that I love to deconstruct and make fun of is the unreal arrogance, I think, to be honest with you, that this particular format, talk radio, has existed with and within and has projected. It's hysterically funny to see so many people taking themselves so serious, especially when they shouldn't be, especially when nothing they have to say, with the exception of maybe one guy. I can think of one guy, and, you know, I'm not going to mention his name because you know who we're talking about, who's been a real shaker and mover in the world of talk radio. That's probably the only talk show we ever needed. You know what I'm saying? In terms of politics, the only one we ever really needed was him, because he's the only guy that anybody has, that anybody takes seriously. He's the guy, even people that hate him, they listen to him. Even people that can't stand him listen to him and take away from his show information. They are informed. And I don't think any other show on the air in talk radio can claim that combination of informative, popular, you know, cat makes money. That's probably the only one we ever needed. Everything else, in my opinion, is a waste. Unless, of course, you listen to Phil Hendry, who made fun of all of that. Or makes fun of all of that. Other than tonight. And maybe tonight we'll get into it as well. Maybe I have been since the very beginning. You know, but be that as it may, you know, what I'm saying here is this. What do we really believe? Well, I can tell you this. As I mentioned, people will claim membership in a political, you know, in a political kind of thinking, in a political party. They'll claim membership in that because they belong to a bunch of people. Maybe it resonates with them because, you know, there's a kind of anger that those people have that is good for them. Maybe their daddy, you know, kicked them out of the house. Their mother took them off the nipple too soon or something. So they need to be a certain kind of political animal. And so they justify it with all of that silly talk that we were talking about. When the guy says, your guy mounted a giraffe. Yeah, well, your guy. So they're never really talking about anything other than how more messed up their guy is than your guy. Well, that's not a political argument of any kind. That's not convincing anybody of anything. That's just being dumb, you know. But people will be dumb if they can belong to a family, even if it's a stupid family. Right? I mean, what did we learn from the Manson family, if not that? Although they were far more than just dumb. I mean, they were murderers. You know, they were antisocial. They were destructive. They were criminals. But they all belong to each other. I don't see any difference between that and half of the stuff that we do in this country when it comes to just about anything. But let's just say, for instance, politics. You know, let's say Republicans. No, I don't see any difference. None at all. I see people identifying with a certain way of life. I'm a conservative. Yeah? Yeah. All right. What? Well, so what does that mean exactly? I just believe in that. You know, I believe in the conservative. So even if there's a liberal thing, no, I don't believe that. Okay, fine, I'm not going to argue with you. Great, that's what I am, and, you know, but your guy mounted a giraffe. Yeah, well, what about the other guy? Bang, there we go again. He doesn't know why he's a conservative. He's a conservative because maybe his dad was. He's a conservative because he loves his country, and he thinks that that's the only, those are the guys I trust when it comes to defending. Maybe he was in the military. I don't know. Because if you get into the specifics of why the guy's a conservative, he couldn't tell you. Same thing with being liberal or Democrat. You want to belong to a bunch of, it's not that who he is, man. It's who he wants to hang around with. It's who he wants to be like. It's who he identifies with. I'd much rather identify with a guy like Romney than a guy like Obama. Who knows why he didn't want to be with Obama? He's a socialist. Is he really? Who knows? Is Romney really a freak? Who knows? The Jews run the world. Is there, you know, all of those things that everybody, I don't know, but sounds good to me, man. I want to be a part of that. I'll join that club. And even if they find out that all the stuff I believe is bullcrap, I'll deny it to the bitter end because I belong. Same thing with this whole thing having to do with sex. Why do you have sex with somebody without wearing protection? Because sex is more important than living. You'd rather die than not have sex. What is that about? Well, it's like belonging to somebody. Am I right or am I wrong? You know, it's all about, maybe it's about love, but it's about connecting. Even people who should connect with everybody and find it difficult to do that, let's say, for instance, really religious people, really Christian people, although, you know, you're supposed to love your fellow man, they can't really do that because my fellow man, some of them are smelly and some of them have got vomit all over them and some of them I don't like. But I know I can love at least one kind of fellow man. I'll love another Christian, you know, so I can hang out with Christ. That's the club they belong to. All right, so we'll continue to investigate this horse dung. I think this is really important, but we have to take another break. And when we come back on the other side of this, well, it's the Phil Henry Show.
Phil Henry.
Welcome back here. Tonight we are dispensing with the normal theatrics of the Phil Henry Radio Show, which has been for years at the. You may not know this. A lot of you guys listening may not know this, and I don't blame you. Our radio show for years, maybe I don't know, but I think that I'm safe in saying our radio show has been at the very top when it comes to shows that are top quality. Satirical presentations on radio, if you will, audio comedy, spoken word comedy, radio comedy. Our radio show has been a top tier show for years. It's been a very edgy show. It's been a show that has been at times baffling and puzzling to the industry. It's a particularly difficult show for a lot of programmers to deal with because we've got this thing called talk radio, and you're only allowed to do politics. So. It would be almost as if saying, I make the greatest tuxedos in the world. That's great, but we only have T-shirt shops, you know. Nonetheless, I'm not complaining. I'm just letting you know that may have something to do with why, not just me, but any time you sort of hit the airwaves in the spoken word world with comedy or satire, people kind of scratch their heads or scratch something else. All right, so enough of that, because I don't want to talk about that tonight. But I'm not doing all the funny voices tonight either. What we're doing tonight is we're going to talk, and we're going to find out exactly, well, we're going to find out exactly who Phil is, maybe. You know, who am I? And that may be interesting, and it may not be interesting. I understand. It's your time is your own, folks. You know, you do whatever you want to do. I think you may find it fascinating. I've never done this before. I mean, I've never really let it all hang out. And that doesn't mean I'm going to be using four-letter words or anything like that. In fact, one of the things I've found in doing a uncensored pre-show on our video cast, which is where we are right now. We have a video cast going on our website, philhenryshow.com. But one of the things I found out is that when you're uncensored, the thing that offends people the most isn't so much the words you use. It's the emotion that you are expressing and projecting. It's the candor that you are showing with the some of the topics that you talk about. One of the things the audience really doesn't like is when you're honest about them. Audiences, just like voters, have never dealt with honesty about themselves very well. Now, I get it. I've got a product. It's called Phil Henry, and I sell it. But one of the things that is a part of that product is my interaction with my audience. It's kind of like saying it's an uncensored show. People think, oh, dirty words. They never, ever really bank on the whole emotional candor part of it. They don't bank on an uncensored show being something that's going to get into uncomfortable territory topic-wise. That's when they, wait, now hold on. When you said uncensored, I thought you meant, you know, saying four-letter words and stuff. No, what I meant by uncensored is uncensored. Well, this is making me very uncomfortable what you're saying. That's what I meant when I said uncensored. Well, maybe I'm not so much into uncensored. Well, you know, you got to make that decision for yourself. Now you're telling me what? You're telling me that honesty, that's what I want. I want truth and honesty. You want truth and honesty? Yes, I do. Tell it like it is. Okay, you suck. Well, now wait just a minute, you know. Well, you said you wanted honesty. You know, but not that kind. That's ridiculous. Everybody's got limits. Everybody, even the most unlimited guy in the world, even a guy that'll tell you that he believes in absolute free speech. Even the people that believe that there should be no limits whatsoever on what people say, even people that will tell you that the onerous effects of the FCC rulings and the blah, 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 that should not happen, and we support the right to a guy to speak his mind. Even those people have areas that they don't want you to get into. They do believe in censorship. Everybody does. Everybody believes in censorship. Don't kid yourself. Yes, they do. Now, some people tell you, oh, sure, I believe in censorship. Here's the censorship I believe. What is that? I turn my radio off. Well, no, you don't. Yes, I do. No, you don't. Not if I was talking about you. Yes, I would. No, you wouldn't. No, you know that you wouldn't. If I was talking about you, you'd leave your radio on. You want to make sure that I don't say anything about you that isn't true or isn't bad or just isn't embarrassing. And that's an impossible thing to turn your radio off from. You will leave that radio on. So everybody not only believes in censorship, everybody at some point can't turn the radio off. I mean, I find this stuff out the hard way, folks. I mean, I've been down this road. I have had listeners and audiences rebel against me for my honesty. Really ugly stuff, too, you know, but they do. And I can't blame them, but I can also say, you asked for it. You know, so there's that. That's a little political discussion we can have. You know, politicians can't be honest. If they were honest, nobody'd vote for them. You know that. I know that. Can't be honest. Why does everybody like Ron Paul? I'll tell you why everyone likes Ron Paul. Do you want to know why? Because Ron Paul can't get elected. Now, when I say everybody likes Ron Paul, not everybody likes Ron Paul. In fact, Ron Paul can't get, bust maybe 5% of the popular vote once we have a general election? Or maybe more. I'll give him more. Let's say 10%. Hell, maybe even 15%. I don't know, but it's nothing that's going to get him elected. Ron Paul is a club that people belong to. You see what I'm saying? It's a club. It's an exclusive club that says, I am different. I am not a part of the two-party system. I'm not even an independent. I'm even cooler than that. I'm a Ron Paul voter. And what's that? Well, it's about constitutional jazz and money and this and that and a whole bunch of really impossible things that are never going to happen. That's what I'm for. Oh, now, so you admit that it won't happen. I'm not admitting that it won't happen. I represent a fringe element that this country needs. I represent something other than the two mainstream, and it's weird to say two mainstream, but we do have two mainstream parties. I represent something other than that. So I'm something that I think the country needs, which is what? Which is a really aberrant, inexplicable political posturing. Can you explain to me what Ron Paul... I think I can, but I probably wouldn't be able to. It doesn't make any difference. You know, it's freedom. It's less government. It's all of those things that I like, you like, we all like. But I like it because Ron Paul says it. Do you think he'll get elected? No, he won't get elected. I don't want him to get elected. If he gets elected, that means the club's too big for anybody to pay any attention to me. I got to find another club to belong to. It's a bunch of wanking, folks. Excuse my French. So what I've found out in just my short time on this planet, it isn't what people necessarily believe. It's the community they want to be a part of, you know? They want to be a part of a community of people. They want to be a liberal, they want to be a conservative, or they want to be a Ron Paul guy, or they want to be the people that live in this neighborhood, or they want to be the people that live in that neighborhood. If you're poor, you find something that's cool about being poor. How can you not? I mean, if you're poor... Are you going to say, I'm poor now, so I'm just a sack of you-know-what, but one of these days I'm going to have money, and then I can talk about how great I am? You ain't going to wait around for that. You're going to talk about how cool it is, not necessarily to be poor, but to come from the other side of the tracks. In fact, people never lose that. People make that up, even if they don't come from the other side of the tracks. They'll find that one or two things that happened in their life that made them a real badass, and they'll keep bringing that up for the rest of their lives. Nobody ever says, I grew up rich. With any pride. That's the only part, the only way you're belonging to the rich community is as someone who achieved something. You cannot say I'm rich if you didn't really achieve it, if you can't prove that it was something you earned. Then you're just a nobody. You're a just you're somebody's rich little boy. You're your mama's boy. You were born with a silver spoon in your mouth. Nobody says that. But a lot of people say I'm rich, I'm wealthy, because I earned it. I got money. Yeah, I got a bunch of companies, and I got a bunch of businesses, you know. Even the wives or the husbands, those individuals that are along for the ride, that maybe they married into it, even they can claim some validation because they earned it by saying, look at the guy I find, married this guy. Or I married her, I married into it. I'm part of their family, I'm part of this big moneyed group. I'm with it, man. They found me acceptable. I earned it. It's ours. This community property thing, man, I'll tell you, some people take it to a pathological extent. Yes, the law does say community property, but you're not trying to tell me that you actually earned that money. It's our money. Yes, but your wife or husband, they go out the door every day to earn that. It's ours. There is no difference. Some people don't get out of bed before 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They got no idea how their spouse makes their money. They are the beneficiary of it. And they probably make a salary of some kind. Maybe they're making in excess of seven figures a year, and they don't even know what he or she does for a living. They're laying in their ass until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's what, that's about. So, everybody belongs to something, but it's got to be kind of a cool version of that. You can't be rich if you were born into it. That's no claim to fame at all. If you're poor because you are a loser, because you had something that you lost, you don't want to claim that either. So it's kind of the opposite. Being born into poverty is a very hip, credible thing that you can take into the world and say, I was born into it. I was raised up in it. I got my ass kicked, and now I'm here to take my bite out of the world. That's good. Being born into wealth, you're just a punk. Nobody ever says when they're an adult, I earned this poverty. No, you want to get the hell out of it. But when you're an adult, you will say, I earned all of this wealth. These are the different little clubs, and these are the different little societies that we can belong to, but make sure you don't overstep or you don't go through the wrong door. And if you're a person of mature years and you say, look at me, I'm poor, I earned it, man, you made a big mistake. So poverty is great if it is a hardcore orientation, if you will. It's where if it's your organic beginnings. That's a fantastic thing. Go into the world, trumpet it, tell everybody what a badass you are, how hard you lived, how hard you came up, and how you fought your way out of there, and now you are at the center of the world. But don't ever, ever, ever talk about your poverty in terms of something that you came to as the result of your failure. Now, here's the big story on all of this. When someone talks about being poor and living hard, they don't ever tell you how they got that way. If they want you to respect them, they'll say they were born into it. But they sure as hell won't tell you that they fell on their ass, had some bad times, and that's where they're living today. They'll just tell you a story so that, you'll love them and respect them. Same thing with money. This exact same thing, Leah, there's sort of a different story. I got money. How did you get it? I earned it. You didn't get born into it. No. Yeah, I worked in my father's company, if that's what you're talking about. But I never know. Who knows if it's true or not? But I personally, Phil Henry, here's what I would rather. And this is based upon a great deal of study. I would rather be rich, having been born into it, and having people point their finger at me and laugh at me as the little Lord Fauntleroy as I lay there with cocoa butter on me by the pool and my mother and father wonder when I'm going to get up off my ass and get a job. I would far more rather be that guy and be laughed at and pointed at and maybe even be provoked into a fist fight occasionally when I go down to the club than to be the guy who is poor and came about that poverty because of failure. No. I'd rather be the moneyed son of wealthy parents. So you see, that kind of embarrassment, that doesn't bother me at all. I think a lot of people are the same thing as me. You guys just haven't looked at it that way. Now, how do we do that? I don't know. I'll figure that out during this commercial break, and I'll come back with an answer. How to get born into money, even though you're now, what, 40? Don't worry. I got an answer coming back. It's the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. This is a night of discovery, and we haven't even scratched the surface. Haven't even gotten close to some of the profane things that I'm feeling tonight. Yes, I said profane. We'll be right back.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show. It's the Phil Hendry Show.
All right, welcome back on this Monday night. We're doing something that we don't ordinarily do, and that is we're stripping away all of the horse dung. Not horse dung. We're stripping away all of the theatrical accoutrements, all of the trappings of the show. We are dispensing with the character voices and the satirical approach. I'm giving it to you as straight as I can, folks, without being too heavy-ass political. You know, I got to tell you, there's only room in the talk radio, in the world, just in conversation, there's only room for politics maybe about 10%, 15% of the time. Nobody in their right mind talks about politics 100% of the time. No one who is walking around and has been given a clean bill of health by the head shrinker is going to walk around talking about politics. If you sit down at a coffee shop, and the guy next to you, and you, I don't know if you guys are like me. Sometimes when I go into a breakfast place, I sit at the counter. Why? Well, number one, because there's generally, if I'm by myself, I'm not really fancy. I will go and I'll sit at the counter. And why do I do that? Because there's generally a place at the counter. And my favorite breakfast place, which I have no problem at all in telling you, is Mrs. Olson's right over here on Hollywood Beach. A fantastic place. Hollywood Beach, California. Hollywood by the Sea, as we call it. Not my erstwhile home of Hollywood, Florida. When I told people that I actually had an apartment there, they stopped and stared at me, and then I would walk away, and they'd still be staring at the space that I had inhabited. In other words, they were frozen in time because people pretty much well over the age of 106 lived in Hollywood, Florida, and I don't know if it's still the same. But I'm talking about Hollywood by the beach, Hollywood by the Sea, which is also by the beach over here. And I would sit at the counter, and as is the case, those of us who eat our breakfast at the counter in the morning, a lot of times we may have just very light, small talk with each other. Yeah, it's really, see the Dodgers, oh, look at that, the Dodgers, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, no big thing. Occasionally there's a guy, though, there's one guy at the counter. And he's the guy that everyone sort of, after a while, recognizes he's doing a lot of more talking than I really want to do. Hey, see those Dodgers last night? That's what he's doing. He's way at the other end. Yeah, they really, boy, I tell you, they put that guy in. Yeah, you're right, man. You know, and you're trying to be nice. Now, I encountered a guy like that, only it was politics. And he was not yelling at me from the other side of the cafe, because that guy is just a mental, you know, he's destroyed mentally. Something happened to him. You know, maybe it was electroshock. I don't know. He might have gotten out, and you're fine, Billy, and everything's going to be good. Okay. You know, he talks at that level no matter where he is. But this guy was next to me, and he was, hi, how are you, sir? I'm very good, thank you. You know, and I'm eating my breakfast. Mm-hmm. So what do you think of the situation right now as it pertains to the country? You, in what sense, sir? Well, you know, we've just had this election. Well, I think that we'll give the president a chance. You know, I'm now I'm eating breakfast, and it's okay. I don't mind talking to the guy, but now I'm wondering, where is he going? We feel that there's always this thing, we. What does he mean by we? There's only one of him, and he's saying we feel. That now I'm beginning to get the sense that he's part of a larger, and here we go again. It's not about what you believe. It's about the community that you're a part of. It's not about what they do. It's about, am I the member of a family or am I not? Because if you tell me I belong, man, I will go to the wall. Some people are that messed up, folks. And you don't have to be in the Manson family. You can be in the Republican Party. You can be in the Democratic Party. You can be in the Ron Paul team. I'm telling you, that's how some people are. Now, a lot of people will say to you, oh, well, sure, Phil, but that's not everybody. I'm telling you that it's the majority of people. I'm not saying that they're crazy. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the driving force is family. It's got nothing to do with belief. Very little. It has more to do with what resonates with you deeper than that. I know. Yeah, you're saying I'm nuts. I'm not nuts. I know what I'm talking about. All I got to do is talk to people who are Republicans or Democrats or Ron Paul, and it doesn't take me more than 2 or 3 minutes to know whether they find out whether they know what the hell it is they're talking about or not. I've talked to people, you'd swear to God they know what they're talking about, but they get right in your face. Let me tell you something, this guy did is... And they immediately go to that place that everybody goes to. The guy that they're against, he's the problem, but tell me about your guy. Well, all right, when we're going to come back, I'll give you more of what happened to me that day in that coffee shop, and also how to make money. I'm telling you, it's way easier than you think. Way easier. This is the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Why aren't I making it? Well, maybe I am. Maybe I am.
Phil Hendry.
Welcome back here to the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. I'll tell you, we have our website, philhendryshow.com. We have a new Lions versus Tucson podcast. The Milwaukee Lions have embarked. That was their last preseason game. Jack Igagdor and Brett Morrison. But all of the comedy and satire that we produce on our show, we're putting to one side tonight. Because every night I'm here and creating some sort of a universe that is a theatrical one, that is a fantasy. It's a satire on the business of talk radio. But it's also just sort of a general satire on people and the human condition and attitudes and different personalities and so forth. But tonight I said, forget it, man. I don't want to do it tonight. Tonight, I just was not in the mood, to be perfectly honest with you. I wasn't in the mood to work that hard. And I felt that there could be more that I could offer you tonight, just bringing myself to the radio the best way I know how. And that's talking to you straight. There's no question, I mean, you've listened to me. There's no question that I'm dissatisfied in a lot of ways. I mean, what guy or woman does a talk show who is not dissatisfied, you know? But I certainly don't put it on. I don't affect it. And I don't have a particular problem, folks, with much of anything in this world. I got a problem. For instance, I don't have a problem with government. Like I was saying last hour, if you talk about politics any more than 15% of the time, there's something wrong with you. Unless it's your job. You know, if you're working in Washington, D.C., and your job is part of the job of the country or the job of a particular state, I understand that, but it's just not healthy. I don't think it's healthy. With all of the discussion that we have in this country on radio of politics, people don't know their ass from a hole in the ground about it. I mean, I don't think we've ever been dumber when it comes to politics. I'm telling you. You know, you look at as I said last hour, most people know they want to belong to some kind of a club. That's it. You say, well, you're really insulting my intelligence, Phil. Well, I don't mean to do that. What I'm trying to say something here that I think is pretty obvious to people. When we get into a political argument in this country, 9 times out of 10, we're just slagging the other person's candidate or slagging the other side. We don't really know how to prop up our own side. And I just think that's because we don't much care you know, what it is we're supposed to represent. We just are part of this team. Now, I just saw they've got four soldiers down in Georgia. These guys have been indicted for murder. They're a militia. They're some kind of an on-base army gang. They killed a man and his girlfriend. They wanted to overthrow the U.S. government. And when I look at these guys, what do I see? I see four guys that used to live in a treehouse together in the backyard of one of their houses. I mean, in other words, I see four guys that haven't grown up. Now, I know they've committed murder. I know that that's serious and that they're going to get, you know, worst case scenario, and one could only hope they would be executed, but, you know, probably not. They'll wind up going to prison for the rest of their lives. But the fact is, these are guys that are not unlike four little boys who go up to a treehouse someplace and they're all upset because they got whipped, or their parents don't love them, or they just feel their dad didn't show up to take them on the play date, or something. They, you know, there's a lot of hurt going on, you know, and they all group together. Next thing you know, they got a little gang, and they run wild, and they show the rest of the world that they're not going to be punks and picked on. I mean, what the hell do you think a gang is? I'll show you you can't hurt me. I'll show you I'm going to hurt you instead. Bang, there it is. Well, same thing with these guys. Four guys going to overthrow the government, my ass. They couldn't get together, man. They couldn't overthrow. I bet you they couldn't throw a bag of garbage into a garbage truck. They know how to kill a man who's on his knees with his hands behind his back. That much they do know how to do. They believe in anything? Hell no. They want to be a part of some club, man. We got a, this country, folks, as far as I'm concerned, is so good, so great to live in. There ain't a whole hell of a lot to find a problem with. I understand that there certain people have a great grievances, but I, you know, I've always believed, and I'm always going to believe this to the day that I die, I don't give a damn how bad it is here. It's better than it is someplace else. And the proof's in the pudding, man. I don't exactly see a migration of millions, you know, jumping on the next boat or plane out of here and heading to some other paradise. So I can't get that crazy about stuff. So what happens? Well, we got to start to trump it up. Let's start making, and I use the word Trump in the sense that, you know, not in talking about him. I don't know whether he's full of crap or not. I'm talking about just crap. He has an unfortunate last name. But what I'm saying is, let's start to make it up. Let's start making it up. Making up what? Making up how bad it is. I ain't saying that things have not been bad in this country. But you know what? We made a hell of a lot of progress. And we've made so much progress that it's pissing off some people. It's upsetting to some people. They want to make sure that we never forget that this place can still be one big stinking sewer. And so let's talk about how we're almost going down the commie road. Let's talk about how we're almost going down the socialist road. Let's talk about how, you know, the right wingers could be taking over and stripping us of our rights. Let's make sure that there's a lot of panic going on, okay? Please? Because it's just, you know, it's not good. It's not American, man. It ain't American to be happy with the country and the way things are going. You can be happy, but you can't. It is not American to be satisfied with your government. That is un-American. I don't have a big problem. The big problems that I've got in this world ain't with the government. It's with some of the dumbasses I work with and some of the, not Dan, I'm not talking about you. It's with some of the dumbasses in my life. Aren't you? Isn't it the same thing with you? Give me a break, okay? Don't tell me the biggest problem you got is the government. Is the government. Tell me the biggest problem you got. Boy, I tell you, if Obama, or it could be somebody else, Bush. Man, are you kidding me? Obama and Bush, and that is a way of avoiding what the real problem. The real problem in our lives has to do with some of these dumbasses we're hooked up with, man. Either in business, in our families, as our friends, somewhere, or when we're looking in the mirror. That's the number one dumbass. And you want to know something? That guy, we never deal with that guy. Man, we're talking morning, noon, and night. We're wrapping a blue streak about all these guys in Washington that are jacking us around and doing this, that, and something else. There's one major dumbass that we look at every morning when we're shaving, and we ain't done diddly squat about that guy. So I told you I was eating breakfast at a diner. And when I sit down at the diner and I sit there at the counter at the diner, it's because there's an open space and I'm generally not with anybody. I don't mind. I'll sit down and, you know, bang elbows with somebody. I ain't bumping them like Larry Craig, you know. I ain't that wide of a guy. I'm talking about at the diner. And this guy's next to me, and he starts in with, he wasn't like the usual guy that's a little bit crackers, as I was saying, who's, boy, those Dodgers, they're really doing great, huh? And he's yelling at you from way down the counter. This guy's right next to me, and he's, well, we believe that, we. I suddenly realized that I was talking to a guy who's obsessed with a topic, most likely how the government is doing stuff. And I realized that not only was he obsessed, but he also was a part of a group that was meeting on a regular basis, and he invited me to one of their meetings. Well, sir, if you'd like to know more, we have a regular meeting over here at, don't be put off by the house. It's been vacant for many years. I live under it. And, you know, he didn't say that, but it was that creepy. Oh, really? Well, thank you very much for the invitation. So, in other words, what I was looking at was the embodiment of everything that I have always suspected about this country and people that are obsessed morning, noon, and night with politics. I think you will drive yourself crazy. I think you become slightly psychotic. I think you are untethered. You no longer have a decent connection to reality. You no longer can talk to other human beings in any way that makes them comfortable. You're all messed up. The worst thing that's going on in America today is everybody yakking this politics stuff, and it starts with this here radio. All these guys, man, I've done my speech. You know, I'm not going to go down that road. You know, talking about how what was, you know, at one time could have been a great format has just been destroyed by this obsession with politics. But I'll tell you this much: I've been to talk radio conventions and I've listened to the hosts and. If ever in your life you want to see the definition of the term self-deluded, go to a talk radio convention and listen to the host. Do you know what happens? Do you know what goes on? Do you think they sit and talk about how are we going to make more money? How can we sell our shows better? How can we market our shows better? Do you know what they do? When they're talking to each other. Do you know what they do? They do their shows. In other words, these are professionals that ought to know, oh, it's a bunch of horse dung, man. Let's figure out how we can get another dollar. How do we sell it better? You think they'd be talking about the professional considerations that one would talk about in any industry, right? No. What are they doing? They're doing their shows for each other. In other words, it's not enough to bullcrap you guys. They go back and start BSing each other. They're talking politics. I saw this happen with my own eyes. I stood and I stared and I couldn't believe it. And it was a packed hall and it was hot and people were sweating and it was just, it was killing me, man. And I was with all these professionals. There wasn't one radio listener there, not one person there that we could call audience. They were all professional people. Some of them might have been consultants. Some of them might have been programmers, but everybody involved in the business. And we were sitting there for an hour bullcrapping each other with politics. Like, how's that going to make me any more money? And how is that going to help my radio show get sold or marketed better? And how is that going to convince the guy that runs the syndication company that my show is being syndicated by to get up off his dead, lazy ass and go out and do some work on my behalf? No, instead of talking about that, these guys, the absolute definition of self-delusion, were thinking they were going to convince me with their bullcrap, like I came there to listen to that. Man, why don't you go back home to your radio station and sell that to your listeners? Don't talk to me. I didn't come here to listen to you. I could care less. Maybe I agree with you. Maybe I don't. And they were being aggressive, and it was almost like they were doing their shows. All right, I'll be back. This is the Phil Hendry Show. Truth is our bitch tonight.
Truth is our bitch. That's Phil Hendry Show.
Tonight. Welcome back here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show tonight. We're talking about me. How about that? You know, And you know, I just got spaced out for there for a second because I saw a headline: "Man fatally shoots former coworker is killed." How old is this? Are these stories that we're looking at here? This is a whole weekend. Is that how fresh the news is? I want to mention you guys in Florida. I hope you're safe, and I know you are. I know that you. I don't think it's. I think everyone knows that they want to be safe. You're not going to do anything dumb. You know. Okay. Cool. Good. Don't. Just checking, because some people think that they can walk out into the middle of that stuff and, it's nothing, you know, those hurricane winds. It depends on the speed of the wind. You can stand, you'll get hurt, but, I mean, you won't get necessarily hurt, but the wind is going to carry you along. But if you hold on to something, well, you know, if you've got something flying through the air right toward your head and it's the wrong thing, it doesn't matter how hard you're holding on to something. I don't know. I'm just telling you. Be cool. Don't act like a dumbass. Most of the people that get hurt in these things are people who, no, I'm not leaving. If they tell you that there is a mandatory evacuation, obviously you got no choice. If they say it's voluntary, well, then you just have to take your chances. I mean, I was in one of those in Florida, and this was for a hurricane that was on its way to the southern coast of Florida in Miami, where I was living. And I was actually living just a little bit north of Miami. It was in North Miami Beach at the time. And that's where this hurricane was going. And it was a voluntary evacuation. So I decided I'd go ahead and I'd evacuate. But I did go back into my apartment, I remember, to get some things. Because I've never lived through a hurricane. I've been through plenty of earthquakes, but I've never actually hunkered down through a hurricane. I've been through some pretty nasty tropical storms, but that's about it. I decided to get some stuff and I would get out of there. And where was I going to go but north? There's nowhere else to go. You're not going to go south because I was going to be further and further into the teeth of the thing. So I decided to go north, and I drove as far north as West Palm Beach because I was tracking this thing, and that seemed to be a safe, far enough away from where this thing was going to make landfall that I decided that I would stay there. And so I did until about, midnight, as I was watching the news, laying there in my hotel room with my stocking feet up and my hands behind my head, as you can well imagine people who are in hotel rooms do, and fully clothed, but there's the, you know, pillow, and I've got a bag of some room service, you know, Chips Ahoy or something sitting next to me. And I look and I see the guy on TV, and he says, "Now, as we are tracking Hurricane Irving," whatever it was called, "and you can see it's turning a little bit north and looks like it'll make landfall in West Palm Beach." So I went, well, this is a son of a bitch. That's a hell of a deal, Irving. So at midnight or 1 o'clock, I forget when, after having just checked in just a few hours before, I got my bags and I got my stuff and I got into my car and I left. And I traveled all the way back down there to North Miami Beach, got into my apartment. And so all that happened was a pleasant trip to West Palm to watch television, basically. Because of my own inexperience, you know, that was my own inexperience with hurricanes. I don't know from hurricanes, at least I don't know the pattern, the history of how these things travel. I've certainly seen enough of them on television, and I've seen all of those weather maps, but I don't know the practical things to do in a hurricane. And I found out that, I know what it was. It was Hurricane Aaron. Hurricane Aaron. And it was back in 95, 96. So that became my one and only experience with those things. And And I lived in Miami for 2 years and had some hellacious rain. And I traveled to work every day in the rain. And when I say I traveled to work every day in the rain, I mean I literally did, because my car, which was a 1985 Chevy Blazer, by that point it was approaching 10 years of age. It had been in a great many different kinds of weather conditions. And one of them was the snow and ice and road salt of Minnesota. Now, I'd driven it in California for 7 years, 5, 6, 7 years, And then I drove it to Atlanta, Georgia, where I went to work at a radio station, drove it around Atlanta, Georgia. Not a big thing, you know. I had some work done on the engine there in Atlanta, Georgia. And it snowed at the end of my stay in Atlanta, but wasn't anything too heavy. And then I motored up to Minneapolis, and it was there that I learned how to drive. I knew how to drive four-wheel, but I learned that it was actually preferable to drive your four-wheel drive truck in four-wheel high in the snow and in the ice. Don't ask me why, but it was. Four wheels, you know, turning as opposed to two is actually better if you're driving on snow and ice. And I found that out in a very practical way. When I was talking to one of the guys at the station, he said, I mean, you got a four-wheel drive, don't you? I said, yeah. Man, put that thing into four high. Have yourself live a little, baby. Because driving home every night, I was going about as fast as the rest of these clowns. They were all going about, you know, 15 miles an hour on the ice. Maybe 20, 25 miles an hour on the ice. He said, no, you can. I said, how does that work? He said, don't ask me. Well, make a long story short, I threw it into four high and there, or maybe four low, I forget. And there I was. There's Phil Hendry. Bang, man. 50, 55 miles an hour going home. You learn something new every day. And that was up in Minnesota. But what I didn't bank on was what the salt would do. Because they road salt up there. That is, when there is ice, they toss salt onto that ice to help break that ice up. Well, that stuff gets onto the undercarriage of your car. And then you are driving in the warm climes of Miami, Florida, as I was, and the next thing you know, you look down and you see the street as you're driving your car. And that's what happened to me. Not only did I have it on the undercarriage of my truck, I had it in the roof. And so I had holes in my roof, and I was being rained on. Yeah. Yeah. Don't tell me I don't know how to save money. Don't tell me I don't know the value of a dollar. I will drive a car until it falls apart underneath me and beyond, until it's not worth anything, until I have to give it away because no one will buy it. Phil Hendry for president. We'll be right back on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Phil Hendry. You're listening to the world famous Phil Hendry Show.
And this is the world famous Phil Hendry Show on this Monday night. No better a night than to tell you where I'm coming from as a humanoid on this here planet, as opposed to going through the gymnastics that we do here at night, character voices and satirical premise and so on and so forth. And who knows, you know, maybe the show will morph into this. I have no idea, you know, but I like I said, I've been doing this show for over 20 years. I've been in talk radio for over 20 years, but I've been in broadcasting and radio for a lot longer. And, you know, I've seen every kind of change. I've seen every kind of technological change. Never seen anything quite like what we're living through now. And that is what is on the horizon. That's internet radio. And I don't know how long you guys have been listening to your particular radio. I don't know if you're really all that well-versed in what's happening in the high-tech world, but internet radio, the download, the idea of multiple platforms, you know, all that stuff sounds confusing. But basically, here's where we're headed. Take out your cell phone and take a look at that, because that's going to also be your radio. I know it's now, you know, sort of your TV in a way. You can get, you know, I can watch YouTube on there too. I understand, but I'm not talking about that right now. Although that will also be your television, and it will. That will be your internet TV. That will also be your portable radio. Put your headphones in on the beach. There you go. You're listening to me, and you're listening to 200, 300, 400 other hosts, other artists. And your radio station will be one in which you can listen to any one of 300 or 400 different people. Right now, for instance, there are broadcast companies that are trying to wedge their way into that world. Clear Channel's one. They have a thing called iHeartRadio, and it's an app. And with all due respect to them, they don't even really know what it is they're dealing with. They really don't. Why do I say this to you? I say it because this is the reality of my world, and I'm having to look at that, and I'm having to adapt to that. Now, one of the good news for me is that in that world, the world that is now occurring in what has been my industry for many, many years, the number one guy in that world is content provider, the producer. In other words, me, the guy that creates the content. The number two guy in that world is the technical guy, the developer of these different platforms, the computer whiz guy. Yes, he's important, but everybody can do that. Everybody is doing that. Everyone is coming up with this version, that version, Wi-Fi this, streaming that, and a lot of other different ways of doing things. But there are very few, as there always has been, very few content creators, developers, and providers. So that's the good news. And it's also good news for you because you're going to have more options. But it's a very, very different landscape from what I came into in 1973 when I was a 20-year-old guy and I was starting out at WBJW in Winter Park, Florida. And I was an overnight disc jockey. I was playing music. And we were coming into a new era. It was called More Music, Less Talk. That was the beginning of it. And if you started talking a lot, they told you to shut up. And everybody was very judgmental with how you said things. And it was a very restrictive environment. But that was the world that I eventually, found my way into. And I didn't even know what it was I wanted to do in radio until I got into my late 30s. And I realized that it was talk radio that I should be in, not music radio, because I really hated the music I was playing. Hated it. I hated it. It's not that I didn't like rock and roll. I love rock and roll. But I don't want to hear Dance the Night Away by Van Halen again, man. I don't give a damn if the audience hasn't perceived it the same way. I had more guys telling me this, that, and something else. I wanted to go into talk radio, and I did. And I only knew how to do it the way that I do it. And the way I do it is real weird. Now, what we're talking about here tonight is an example of the way I see things. Politics? You got to be kidding me. Politics to me is like religion. Talk about it on your own time. Talk about it with your friends. Go to a city council meeting. Don't talk to me about it. Well, who are you voting for? None of your business. What do you think of that? I'll tell you who I'm voting for when we're in the right forum for that kind of a thing. But what we've done is we have jaw-jacked this topic to the point where you think people would be happier, right? You'd think we'd be more informed. You'd think that we'd be making better decisions than ever before. I mean, this country, it doesn't deal with it that way. Politics in America, folks, you got to understand, is not something we engage in a discussion over so we can solve problems. It's something we engage in a discussion over so we can be in the right club, the right family, so we can settle into a lifetime of, excuse me for saying this, being dumb. We can just sit there and be dumb. We can be this part of the family or that part of the family, join this club, join that club. And that's where we're going to be for the rest of our lives, and we'll never change. And I got no interest in talking about that crap at all. Unless I can make a couple of dollars at it. And then I will lie with the best of them. Talk about politicians lie. Politicians are in only one business. They're in the entertainment business. Why? Because that's what we want them to do. Wait a minute, Phil. Now you're really losing me. No. What do you mean I'm losing you? You know what I'm talking about, don't you? No, I don't. What do you mean? Politicians are in the entertainment business just as much as anybody, just like teachers are. Teachers? Yes, teachers. Teachers are the entertainment business. Teachers will tell you, I've got to come up with some kind of a lesson, some kind of a plan, a lesson plan for the class today, because those kids will go home and watch television and watch any one of a number of different offerings entertainment-wise that I can't even hope to compete with. I got to come up with some way of holding their interest. I have to, in my own way, be compelling. Same thing with politicians. The guy out there that thinks Obama is a douchebag is never, ever going to change his mind. Never. Never. Even if he is, even if he's been presented with solid gold proof that Obama's not a douchebag, he'll tell you it's impossible. The guy out there that thinks Romney and all Republicans are the scum of the earth will never, ever change his or her mind. Never. Even if you presented them with the absolute solid gold proof that Romney is not. Never. Now, you say to me, well, yeah, but what about cats like David Mamet? You were just talking about him, Phil. And what about Dennis Miller? And what about you, Phil? You changed a lot. No, I didn't. I'm still the same old Democrat. Just so happens that my patriotism and my fervor for preserving my country came to the fore after 9/11. And it may be the same case with a guy like Dennis Miller. Maybe David Mamet actually did change his mind and become a born-again conservative, but those stories are few and far between. You will never, ever, ever convince people who hate Obama that there's something worthwhile about the man, and you're never going to do the same thing for anyone that hates the Republicans like Romney. It ain't going to happen. So if you're one of those people who feels you got, I've got every reason in the world not to like Romney, why he's this, that, just, why don't you just admit, why don't you give us all a break? Do us all a favor and stop it. Stop, not, no, I'm not asking you to like Romney. No, I'm just saying quit bullcrapping us about it because we saw you coming down the street five blocks back. You will never, ever change your mind. Because you can't invest a lifetime of being a liberal. You can't invest a lifetime of that into being a liberal and then all of, and then let the truth get in the way. Now, I know what you're saying. You're saying, Henry, you are talking nonsense. People are not that stubborn. Yes, they are when their own personal survival and happiness is at stake. Yes, they are. If you ask a man to change his politics, it's like asking him to change his religion. It's like asking him to change his woman. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's a lifelong commitment. It's a lifelong mating. He makes more love to his politics than he does his wife. We do a character on our show named Larry Grover, and Larry Grover was based in part on the reality, the political reality of America that was happening in the late 1990s, the obsession over the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Right or wrong, President Clinton should have been impeached or not. I'm not arguing that. But the obsession that some had was something that it was very real. And we created this character who lost his wife, lost his daughters, lost his home, lost his business, and was sleeping now on a cot in his mother's kitchen because he was just so obsessed with getting Bill Clinton out of the White House, impeaching his ass, and throwing him out into the street that every other aspect of his life had gone into the toilet. Kind of like drugs, you know. It's kind of like alcoholism. But I don't see any difference. Now, I told you before we got into this next break, I'm going to do it. We got a break coming. I'm going to do this. I'm going to tell you how to make some money. Okay? I'm going to give you an example. I'm not knocking Michelle Bachmann, please. She is a great example of a politician who's an entertainer. She's fantastic. She's fantastic. She's great. I'm beginning to think, and I'm not going to be that stupid, because I remember when I thought that the Phelps family, God hates fags, I remember when I actually thought that they were putting everybody on. Now, they're not putting people on, but they still are very entertaining. And if they ever wake up, they can make themselves so much money. I can't even begin to believe. I mean, they're a traveling comedy troupe, the Phelps family. Yes, the things they say are ugly, but they're so far extreme that they're a characterization of themselves. It's like the Poe rule, or what do they call it, where it is impossible to satirize certain people because they're a walking satire. The Phelps family is it. That's it. They're a walking satire. You cannot do any better, man. I saw a guy from an Australian TV station try to do it. He went over to old man Phelps at some kind of a protest that they were having and tried to come on to him as if he was gay. In other words, it was like a homosexual come on to see what Phelps would do. It didn't work. It fell flat because Phelps just stonewalled the guy with his religious rancor. You know, he's just, that's fine. Well, go find yourself a boyfriend. It didn't work. you know. Well, Michelle Bachmann, to me, if she ain't serious, she's fantastic. Now, she says a lot of whack stuff. And the other day, I was thinking about this. I said to Dan tonight, Michelle Bachmann, like tonight, is reported to have said in Florida that there is a spiritual hurricane coming to Florida just as much as a real one. There's a political hurricane coming to Florida just as much as a real one. And we better get right with him. And I'm asking myself, what is she doing? She's raising money. She's making money. She's making a lot of money. She's dropping a religious theme into her political pitch because what are you going to do? Are you going to go out there and start talking all your Republican right-wing stuff? Or, you know, you could be a Democrat. Same difference. You're going to go out there and talk all of your ideology. And what are you going to hope to gain from that? A piece of the Mitt Romney pie? A little bit of the... She was a candidate for the presidency of the United States. Michelle Bachmann is better than that. She's bigger than that. When she started laying that Jesus stuff on, she didn't say Jesus, but she started laying that God stuff on people. Now you're talking, baby. Now you're talking. Now she's talking God talk. And that's worth money. She's raising money because money's good. And I ain't talking about raising money for another run at the presidency. I'm talking about raising money. So her and the 19 kids or whatever she's got, her and, you know, her fine gentleman husband there, well, I forget his name. I forget his name because all I see is him sort of mincing in. Well, I better not say. But so that they can live well. And that Jesus talk, that God talk, that separates, if you'll pardon the expression, the men from the boys. In this case, it separates the woman from the boys. Michelle Bachmann has got it all over the rest of those clowns when it comes to just motivating people and getting people out there and getting people whipped up and getting people excited over what and who and what you might be, because she knows how to lay that God talk on people. She ties it right in to the political pitch, and it's worth more than anything. It's worth more than Romney. Romney raises a lot of money because Romney knows a lot of rich guys, and Romney himself is very, very wealthy. But Michelle Bachmann, for somebody that just came out of Yahoo, Minnesota, man, she knows exactly where the bodies are buried, baby, and which the lay of the land and the which side of the bread the butter's on and all that other stuff. When we come back, we'll figure out what we're into. The bread, the butter, the lay, the land, probably the lay. The world-famous Phil, and I say that in the Hawaiian sense, as in laying a Hawaii, I mean the Hawaiian lay. Well, you know what I mean. This is the Phil Hendry Show. We'll be right back, and
Truth
I will explain
is
further.
Our bitch. The how Phil I'm Hendry wealthy. Show.
Glad to have you here. Glad you're with me. Glad you're watching me on Phil TV and HD if you are. I'm glad you're listening to me. I'm glad you're going to download this tomorrow if you're going to download it. I'm glad you're a subscriber. I'm glad for the business that we do. I'm glad for the business that I do because I don't see this as any different from anything else having to do with business. I said one time I was over on Twitter. I go, I don't have, you know, I think I have 10,600 followers on Twitter. I said, I don't have followers. I've got customers. I got customers. And I try to interact with people over there on Twitter as much as I can. Sometimes it's very, very difficult to... It's tough to know what to say, man. You know, in other words, it's easy to say, oh, hey, thank you very much. Hi, how you doing? But you know, some people are so good with those tweets, man. They're just real, you know, funny, man. And I don't... I spend most of my time here on the radio show doing the radio show. By the time I get off the air and I'm over on Twitter, I got nothing more to say other than please listen to me, or hey, here's a link to something cool we just did, or hey, here's a link to something else cool that we did, or hey, here's a link to a link to a link to a, you know, you'll find something. But I do. I think I've got 10,500 customers. Money these days, folks, I know what you're saying. You know, didn't you tell us you're going to say how you make money, Phil, or how you would make money? Oh, yeah, I'm going to tell you more than that. I'm going to tell you how I ignore and how you probably do too. But here's the thing. I don't want to do a Bruce Williams thing on, you know, let me tell you something, my friend. Here's how to make money. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm trying to say is this. I pass up ways of making dough all the time. The other day, I was approached by someone who said, why don't you do a broadcast workshop, man? Why don't you do a broadcasting school? Why don't you do broadcasting lessons, Phil? And you could sell these lessons. You could do a broadcasting school. You could make a lot of money. And he's right. He's right. If I put an ad in any of the journals and it said, Phil Hendry Broadcast Workshop, now I'm going to show you how to be an entertainer on radio, audio, podcasts. I'm going to show you how to be a performer, a satirist, using the spoken word medium. I guarantee you right now I'd make thousands a month. I'd make thousands a month. You realize I could charge $1,000 for a 30-day lesson, and I'd probably get, what do you think? Oh, you know, well into the hundreds. Because there's nobody who knows how to do that. There's nobody who knows. No, I'm the only guy in this business. I'll take that back. I'm not the only guy in this business, but I'm a guy with a unique set of skills. Not only could I show people how to present themselves in terms of personality, but also the aspect of doing character voices, of creating characters, and creating this kind of theater I could do. Now, not everybody knows how to do that. I could do it, and I would make a lot of money. Why don't I? Well, it turns out that as much as I like money, now I'm being honest with you right now. It develops, as Damon Runyon used to write, it develops that I must not like money that much, man, because there's some things I draw the line at. Now, I'm telling you right now, this would not take a lot. It could be mail order. I could send out the lesson. I could say, hi, I'm Phil. I could do it on tape. I could do it by way of Skype. I could give people a private line and they could join me here on the video cast, and I could give them lessons in broadcasting. You know, there's a lot of ways that I could do this, and I would make a ton of money. Now, understand that the money that I made, it would all be up front, and gradually it would probably tail out as the market for this sort of thing dried up. But I could make thousands, and why don't I do it? Because there's some stuff I draw the line at. There's some ways of making money that I can't bring myself to, and I'm sure that, you know, you can well imagine, if you want to call it prostitution or whoring yourself, yeah, now, you know, you'd sort of get close to that concept. But there's more to it than just that. So seeing as how I'm hearing music, we'll talk about it on the other side of this break, The Phil Hendry Show.
Phil Hendry. Broadcasting from the shores of El Pacifico, Phil Hendry.
Welcome back here. Just taking a brief, I'm showing to my close personal friend, Mr. Northcraft, this Joe Bonamassa guitar. You see this thing, Dan? Guitar Buzz. Now, if you know blues guitar, maybe you've heard of Joe Bonamassa. He's an artist that's making quite a bit of noise, and that's because he can't play guitar very well. No, I'm kidding. He's a great guitar player. People are following this guy, but the body type on this thing, it looks like it's an acoustic, but it's pretty interesting. And I'm a blues music fan. I don't say that because I want any particular adulation. That's another thing. People say that they like a certain kind of music because that's part of their, you know, the presentation, you know. So I guess what I'm saying is there's all kinds of persona in this world, and we all have personas, and that's just a fact. You can't deny it. Psychologists tell us that we all have different individual personas. We have, that's what we present to the world. What you present to your family is different from what you present to your professional colleagues and so forth. The person that you present to your the lady in your life when you first meet her is going to be almost 180 degrees different in a lot of ways from the person she eventually gets to meet, you know, gets to know when you get married and you start living together. Never in your wildest dreams, and never in her wildest dreams, more to the point, when you first met each other and she was falling in love with what a stud you are, and you were sweeping her off her feet, never did she ever really imagine that day that you'd be sitting there in a chair crying like a baby over some problem, maybe a work problem, or somebody hurt your feelings, or I'm not knocking it, but she's suddenly looking at this guy who was all man, and now he's this, I don't know what I did, baby. You know, it's kind of probably a shock, you know. Probably the healthiest guy from that, you know, if you're a man, the best thing you can do is be a man to her, because you know that that's what attracts women. But pretty in short order, let her know, you know, I'm not, you know, I've had my days, you know, and I'll tell you right now. Well, aren't you going to protect me? No, no, you don't say that. But I used to joke about this, and I think it's one that we ought to. What happens between the time that you were having the long walks on the beach to the time that she is putting parts of your body into trash bags and loading them into the back of a truck to dispose of them someplace out of town? What happened between those two? Well, nothing really. What do you mean, Phil? No, nothing really happened. What happened is she happened. You know, you just didn't see it coming, Charlie. See, the day she met you and you walked on the beach and had the candlelight dinner, that person was already the one that was going to put you into those trash bags and dump your body at the dump. That person, she was already there. What happened was, she happened on you, man. She happened while you were thinking something else. You know, I love these shows. I mean, I just love these crime shows where he had no emotion. Because I'm just like those people. How could they not have? And I now realize, I now am fully and completely accepting of, there are personality types in this world that we haven't even begun. We don't even have the first clue at the human animal. We're just now beginning to understand some of the types that are out there, you know. Now, let me tell you something. I was telling this to my stepson, Alex. We were coming back from a business meeting last week. And he was going on and on and on about, and as well he should. He's a young man in his early 20s, and we had just heard a business proposal, and he was very excited about it, as was I. But we're both coming at it from slightly different places. I'm coming at it from having been in business for a lot of years, and he's coming at it from now just entering his professional life. And I'm not saying that I'm smarter than him. It's just a natural, I mean, for you young people listening, believe me, I don't like anybody telling me how it is either. It's really unnerving and it's boring. But even you would say and admit, if you've been further down a road and you meet someone and they ask you, are there potholes up ahead? I think I should tell you there's a few up here, and that's only because you went down that road already. If you try to tell someone, well, there's some potholes, and they go, don't give me your bullcrap view of this road. I'm going to go down that road, man. I'm just trying to tell you it ain't really that much different. I know it sounds simplistic. It's really not that much different. I'm telling you the truth. It's the same thing. It's not, let me just tell you how it is. Nobody really wants to do that. I sure don't. I sure as hell don't want to say to my kids, let me tell you how it all rolls out. No way, man. I want them to find their way and have a ball with life. But if you're going down there, yeah, can I just say so? What? There's a big-ass hole, man, on the other side of that hill. Yeah, but I don't think that, well, okay, then you got to just kind of put your fingers in your ears like in those cartoons, like when the one character knows a big stick of dynamite's about to go off, and you're just like, uh-oh, here it comes, bang! And then you see your kids staggering over the hill like, Why don't you tell me about just like Donald Duck, you know, or whatever the guy's name is, Daffy? So we're driving home, and he says, man, this is a beautiful thing. I said, yeah, it's got some good. He says to me, there's this, and there's this, and there's this. And I said, yeah, there is. I said, I just want to tell you something, man. I said, you know, there's an old saying in business. If it's too good to be true, it ain't true. He says, well, because he'd heard that one before. And he said, well, all right, well, I mean, there are some drawbacks. Yeah, well, what do you think? And he says, well, I can see where there's this and there's that. He said, but they sort of are outweighed by the fact that X is Y and Z is X. You know, I don't want to give you the whole thing of what we were talking about, but he's... And I said to him the best piece of... This was absolutely the greatest thing that I could possibly say to him. I said to him, I'm going to tell you, Alex. Right now in my life, I would love to embrace a business model for our company that is going to ensure income. I can tell you, because, you know, I've been busting my ass my whole career, man, and I've had ups and I've had downs, and, you know, there's nothing like having a nice, solid income stream. But I said, you know, there's an old saying, I said, you know, you prepare for the worst, you hope for the best, but you prepare for the worst. And he said to me, yeah, and he answered like a lot of young people would. He said, that seems like a pretty negative mindset.
Now, you know, I had a lot of different things I wanted to say to that, but I'm just going to lay this one on you. You know, positive thinking and all that jazz, man, you can take that and you can stick that you know where. Forget it. That's just the wrong thing to be talking to me about. But I didn't say that to him. This is what I said to him when he said, positive, you know, that's a negative. You prepare for the worst, but hope for the best. Seems I said to him, I got to tell you, man, because I've been there, that your worst nightmare, they do come true. I know that there's that saying, boy, your worst nightmare, you don't want it to come true. The worst nightmare and his worst, it happens. It does happen. The worst thing. Some of us think that if we think about the worst thing that could happen to us, that somehow we diffuse it, that we take away its power. You know, there's a thinking in Eastern mysticism that goes along the lines of, if you vent it enough, it won't happen. Maybe dreaming about bad things is a good thing. So there are psychologists that say that's a way that we unstress. That's a way that we let all that bad stuff out of our subconscious, and we let that stuff take shape in our mind somehow, like in dreams, and we take the power away from it. I am living proof that that doesn't happen. I'm living proof. I used to dream about the bottom falling out, and it has in my life. So I said to him, I said, you know, you do, man. You do hope for the best, man. You do hope for the best. You work for the best, and you be smart, and you plan, and you, but you got to be ready, man. Because I was telling him, at the end of a year or 2 years of being in business, what is the worst case scenario? You have to think about that. Well, I want to think positive. No, man, you gotta, what are you going to do if you're at this place and not at that place? What is your contingency, man? You must think of that. You have no choice but to think of that. Because I said, your worst nightmares can come true. And that's where, you know, when I learned that lesson in my life, all that positive thinking is fantastic, you know, and I'm sure that it's true and all of those marvelous things. But you just give me smart and hard work, and you can keep positive thinking. Yeah, I want to have a good attitude, but it's better to have a good attitude so you're just kind of greeting the world with a smile. That's where you want to have a good attitude. A good attitude where you're sitting there going, oh, I hope, I hope, I hope, I hope, I hope. It's a waste of energy. Go out, work hard, make contacts, take chances, yeah. You got to take chances. To be successful, you have to take chances. You must. You have no choice. In order to be successful, you must take chances, and you also have to figure on something else that most people don't figure on. It doesn't matter what kind of person you are. The more successful you get, the more people are going to dislike you. Believe it or not, it doesn't make any difference how nice you treat people. That's got nothing whatsoever to do with it. The more successful you become, the less certain people are going to like you, until finally you'll know you've really hit the heights when they hate your guts. Now, that's the truth. But, man, that positive thing. So we had this discussion in the car, you know. And at the end of the discussion, though, we both sort of agreed this is a really good move to make. We're going to make the move. We got to have a whole bunch of more answers before we do. And that's kind of the planning, you know. And like I said, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. Because we've broken our ass to get where we are. And we've broken our ass to make the money that we've made. But, you know, to get further, we got to roll the dice a little bit. All right, we'll be right back here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. As late as I am with this break, I know Dan's been taking notes, probably has been recording this segment, and will repackage it and resell it on his own private website. I have no idea. We'll be right back. Phil Hendry Show. If you do, Dan, good luck.
Bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
Joe Bonamassa, we were just looking at Joe's pictures here on Phil TV and HD. He obviously is a guy that, he's in love with a guitar. I mean, this guy looks like he's got like 100 different guitars. But I like blues music, and I'll tell you, if you're interested, Dan asked me, he says, you know, because Dan said to me, what is it with you and blues music? Now, he didn't say that, but some people will ask that. And I like blues music, but the way I came to liking or loving blues is very interesting. And it came to me at a very young age. I was probably 12. And before that, I was already a music fan that was a little different for an 11 or 10-year-old boy. Not that much. I bet you that kids, wherever kids are, whenever they're alone and they take a hold of some music, maybe it's the music source their parents have, maybe not, that we would probably be surprised at what it is they like. I mean, we think kids like what they like, hip-hop or modern rock or what have you, but kids like all kinds of music, you know. One of the kids growing up, they like classical music, show music, lots of different stuff. So I'm a kid of 12, or even younger than that. I would listen to my dad's jazz records. He had Dave Brubeck, and he had my father had a double album set that fascinated the hell out of me. It was a Benny Goodman live at Carnegie Hall, and it was the old discs. Now, first of all, those of you who remember vinyl at all, remember very flexible, light vinyl. If you collect vinyl, you'll note that it's rather flexible, it's light. It's easily scratched. But before that, there was a much harder, almost made of, it looked like it was made of some kind of a material that wasn't vinyl. It was a harder plastic, big, thick, heavy discs. Do you recall watching cartoons maybe, or maybe a Three Stooges, where they would throw those discs and they would shatter like plates? That's because they were as heavy and as impermanent as a dish. And my dad had these records, and they were so literally physically heavy that they came in boxes. You didn't really get them in a sleeve so much as if it was a double record set, it would be in a box. And he had this thing live at Carnegie Hall. I listened to this record for two reasons. I dug the music, especially Gene Krupa's drum solos. I thought were fantastic. I loved listening to his drum solos. And also listening to this, you heard the jazz fans in the background. It was a little bit of a history. It was a bit of a time machine because you could hear these sort of the hep cats of the 30s. You could hear them hooting and hollering as Krupa would do these drum solos. So that's the kind of kid I was. I mean, I loved rock and roll. And I listened to all the music, top 40 music. But by the time I got to be 12 years old, 11 years old, I met a kid at school named Richard Wood. Richard Wood was this kid's name, believe it or not. And he came from a family, his father was an engineer. He had lots, typical Catholic family, seven kids in the family. He had one, two, three brothers and two or three sisters, you know. And I go to his house, and his father was an engineer down at Martin Marietta in somewhere down off the San Bernardino Freeway. And as much money as engineers made in those days and still do, this poor guy was struggling to keep seven kids fed and clothed and going to private school, Catholic school. And there was Richard, kind of the middle son. And he was a free-spirited guy, and I liked the guy. We met each other at school. We were both in the sixth or seventh grade. So I rode my bike down to his house one day. And he says, come on. So we got onto our little bicycles, little kids there in Arcadia, California. He says, come on, man, let's go up to the library. Okay. That wasn't weird for me because I liked libraries. And we rode our bike up there, our bikes, and we get into this library. And here's this little 12-year-old kid. I think he was about a year older than me. And I still know Richard. He's out there in L.A. someplace. He's still a music fan. And I'm following him, and he takes me right back to what they used to call in those days the audio-visual department in the library because they had records. They had all these records. And he says, yeah, let's get some headphones. I didn't know the first thing from this place. There were records, there were turntables, there were headphones. So we got some headphones, and he immediately goes over, this 12-year-old kid, and he goes over to the record library and starts pulling out Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and Lightning Hopkins, and he starts pulling out Sun Ra, and he starts pulling out Big Bill Brunzi, and he's pulling out... you name it, man, Lead Belly and Muddy Waters. And for 3 or 4 hours, these two little white boys there in Arcadia, California, at the public library, we sat and we listened. Oh, and the John Lomax collection was a mind blower. John Lomax was a guy that was paid by the United States State Department to travel the South with a tape recording machine. And he stopped at cotton fields because during lunch breaks or dinner breaks, the workers would break out their guitars and would start playing blues, folk music, what was called in those days Negro spirituals. This was very indigenous American music, and the United States government wanted to record it lest it be lost forever. And the only place you could do it was literally get into a car and drive down to these cotton fields. Well, Robert Johnson was discovered. Lead Belly was discovered. I believe Muddy Waters was discovered in these cotton fields with these recordings. And so we listened to that, too. And I'm listening to these thin little recordings of these voices from 30, 40, 50 years before. And I don't know why, I don't know what it was about me, but I fell in love with that music. I wanted to hear more of it. And when I finally heard what they called, what we called in those days, the Chicago sound or the electric sound, which was Paul Butterfield and Charlie Musselwhite, and this electrified sound of the blues that had come up the Mississippi River, as they say, from the New Orleans Delta all the way up to Chicago. When I finally heard that, that became a love affair that I've had for my entire life. And if you want to see me dance, and you don't want to see me dance, but if you really do want to see me dance, then follow me into a blues club some night, and you'll see me dance, and you'll probably see me get thrown out. I'm just kidding. We'll be right back. Phil Hendry Show. That's the story of the blues. It came up the Mississippi to Phil's house.
Phil Hendry.
Back here, just a few more minutes to go here on this very unusual night. This has been a night sans character voices. It's been sans the usual satire and theater that we do. It's been without any of that, any of the bells and the whistles. And it just was a night where I felt like I would kick back and talk with you and talk a lot about myself.
not because I've got an ego problem. I've got an ego. There's no question about that. I couldn't do what I do without an ego. But I don't think it's a problem. I'm not a narcissist, which means I don't think I'm overly involved with myself to the detriment of others. And so I think I'm healthy in that way. Now, this has been a night where we haven't, you'll notice, talked about the things that one might talk about when one does a talk show, because I couldn't be more sickened by the subject of politics. And by that, I mean, I don't mean that I don't respect politics. I do respect politicians. I respect people in Congress. I respect the president. I'm real old-fashioned that way. I think anybody that has the patriotic inclination to run for the House of Representatives or the United States Senate, I think the best of that person. I don't think the worst. I understand that there's things that happen in Congress. There are power struggles, and there's a way of doing things and a way of not doing things. I don't have a rancor or a venom or poison building up in me about the government. I'm not Joe Stacks, you know, whatever that guy's name was. Joe Stack, remember him? That he just couldn't take it anymore? And so whatever it was bothering that guy. And I understand that the tax code had somehow changed, and I understand all kinds of things went wrong in Joe's life. And I get it. And it sucks. And I'm sorry about that. And the way he tried to deal with that was by killing. I'm not talking about he killing himself. I could care less. He killed an innocent man. He didn't care. It didn't bother him. He wasn't thinking about anything other than what he needed. And I suspect that that was probably Joe's problem his whole life. The only person that was really important to him was him. What he needed, what he had to have, what he didn't get, what he wanted to get, what he didn't get, what he thought, what he didn't think, what he ate, where he slept, him. And when he didn't get what he wanted, he burned down houses, he took off in an airplane, he smashed it into a building, and he killed an innocent human being in the process. And don't think for 5 seconds that he didn't consider that option. He probably did, and he didn't care. Like he didn't care all of his life about anything other than him. So you can talk all you want about problems with the tax code and poor Joe this and poor Joe that. That guy should only be burning in hell right now as far as I'm concerned, because I don't care what problems you got or what's going on with the country or how onerous this terrible totalitarian fascist commie government. Oh my goodness, the American people, what an unlucky lot we are. Boy, I don't know what kind of a drug you got to take to get yourself thinking in that direction. But man, I don't think I need any of that. You got to have some serious problems, Jack. And don't tell me about Joe Stacks and how the system did it to him. That guy's a murderer, and he's where he ought to be. And I don't give a damn what his problems were. Everybody got problems, man. Everybody. So I look at the country that we've got, and I've said this as a joke, you know, many times on the show, but I say it very seriously now, because it happens to be a fact. If you open your eyes long enough, you will see something that is very, very true, and that is the person most likely to be violating your privacy, sticking a camera up your rear end, videotaping you having sex, videotaping you going to the bathroom, videotaping you doing something maybe you shouldn't do, the person most likely to violate your privacy and to share those secrets with the world is not the government. Today, we find that it is more often than not likely to be a neighbor. Just one of the great unwashed. One of the regular people. Now, that kind of throws a monkey wrench into what has been traditionally, you know, the sort of default reality for people, and that is everything would be great if Big Brother wasn't staring up our rear ends at everything. Everything would be great if the government could just get the hell out of the way. Isn't that right? It's more likely that the paranoid and neurotic public that has existed, you know, since the beginning of time. Human race, in other words. The human race. You know, you're going to look at what's wrong with the country, you're going to be looking in the wrong place. It isn't that people are bad. It takes all kinds. There's all kinds of weird asses working in the government. There's no question about that. But guess what? I got a newsflash for you. There's a whole bunch of them living on your street, too. I am very proud to say the following thing. And I know that there are many, 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 many people just like me. But I wasn't fooled by Joe Stacks, not even for 3 seconds. That guy was just a scum-sucking dog as far as I was concerned, regardless of the problems he was having. The minute he took the life of another human being, a veteran for God's sake, but let's forget about the veteran status of the man, just another human being, and in such a cavalier manner, his problems with Big Brother, his manifesto, his attempt to become something more than he was in life, which was a loser, it went up in smoke as far as I was concerned. But in point of fact, he showed us who he really was. Anybody who is that angry at a government that is the greatest that the human race has ever conceived of, he's got problems upstairs between his ears, and it's going to take a lot of medicine and electroshock. Forget about what he's crying about. I could care less. When I finally got looking into that guy's troubles, and I found out that he'd made a series of bad decisions, and then I took a look at how he ended his life, and I realized what we're dealing with here is probably a full-blown sociopath or narcissist. All of these decisions made by a guy with a mindset like that, you're not surprised. Those guys can't plan going to the bathroom for a bowel movement. They wouldn't know where to begin. Do I bring toilet paper or what? Are you kidding? No, I don't. So, I mean, I got no problem with the government. Now, you know, I'm not black, I'm not a woman. As far as I'm concerned, the only minority groups in this country that have any right to say anything are the following people: women, Jews, blacks, Native Americans. That's it. As a minority group, if you want to, I know that there's a lot of minorities. I'm not arguing that. But who have a legitimate right to say we were institutionally brutalized, not just by the American government, but by every government, by governments all over the world, by governments certainly in the western part of the world, in Western Europe, there was legal slavery, African slaves. America wasn't the only country. Women, Jews, blacks, Native Americans. Those four groups, in one way or another, were institutionally separated from the rest of society. And when I say institutionally, I mean there was a big fat brand stuck on them, either as a slave, as a money-grubbing Jew, she's a woman, she's a second-class citizen, or he's a savage. Those four groups of people, in my opinion, have cause to make the claim we were left out. All right? And the country, my country, has made every effort in the intervening years to bring those people back into the family of American citizenship. Everybody else, I take on an individual case-by-case basis, and that includes my Hispanic friends and my Asian Pacific friends. Yes, even my Japanese American friends. The internment, a terrible thing. There was an attempt to, as I say, redress that with reparations. But all of the other so-called minorities... Oh, excuse me, I left out one group of people, I apologize, gay people. Women, Jews, blacks, Native Americans, and gay people. Those five groups of people institutionally brutalized by this country and many others. Institutionally victimized, institutionally separated and branded, and there ain't no getting around it. Everybody else I take on an individual case-by-case basis. Well, wait a minute, Phil. I'm Chinese-American. That's great, but you know what? Your name is what it is, and I'm going to talk to you about your problems, and I get it that it was tough for your grandfather when he's building the railroads. You don't understand. There's people saying, yeah, man. Because what I find is it gradually becomes a state of mind and a condition that cannot be relieved or alleviated by anything. It just is. You know, I am a minority. It's kind of like people who are, I'm a cancer survivor. At what point do you stop being a cancer survivor and you just start living? Can you tell me that? At what point do you stop being a cancer survivor and identifying yourself as a cancer survivor and going to meetings as a cancer survivor and walking down the street as a cancer survivor and going into the house as a cancer? At what point do you stop with that and just start living? You know, that's the problem we got, man. Yeah, I know you had cancer. That's and you survived. Fantastic. I'm glad to see that you've survived, okay? Are you done with your cancer survivor meetings now? Well, how dare you? Why would you? Wait a minute. What do you mean, how dare I? What is it, for the rest of your life you want to be a cancer survivor so everybody's got to walk on eggshells around your stupid ass? Stop with your cancer survivor. You're a survivor. You're alive. You're walking down the street. Everything's good. Fantastic. Well, you know, I had a double mastectomy. Well, you know, okay. So you can get yourself some reconstructive surgery. What, are you going to become a reconstructive surgery survivor? Stop it. And stop being a minority. But having said that, in my studies, gay people, Native Americans, black people, women, and Jewish people were very much branded as outsiders, as the other, which is a term they use in psychology. You can grow up feeling like you're the other. You're not a part of. You are the other. And this is a real and very destructive frame of mind for some people to have. All right. We'll be right back. Let's see if I've left anybody else out. I don't think so. World famous Phil Hendry Show on this, an unusual Monday night, but nonetheless, unnecessary Monday night. We'll be back. Don't forget
Truth
the Lions versus
our
Tucson,
bitch.
Man.
The Phil Hendry Show.
PhilHendryShow.com. And that's one thing it is. My name's on it, so it's got to be that. And I've had a very pleasant evening with you. I hope you did, too. Talking about some of the things that I believe, because I'm so important, aren't I? Well, if you're listening to my show, I guess that's what you probably don't think I'm important, nor should you. But there's some part of you that says, well, I want to hear what he has to say about certain things. Now, the last comment that I made about this whole cancer survivor, you've heard people, the victimhood thing. There's one other area that we were talking about during the break that is always fascinating to me, and that's people that are recovering alcoholics, making, as Dan mentioned during the break, making a big proclamation. I'm a recovering alcoholic. You know, I don't really care. You know, and if you're looking for me to pat you on the ass, I don't care. What you just did there, man, is you've taken one half of a step. Actually, you took one step of the two necessary to do what I think you're about to do, which is what? Tell me that you're in AA? Yeah. Okay. You know, people don't much care anymore, I guess, but AA is called AA for a reason. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's a reason why they call it Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with the individual alcoholic. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the individual not telling anybody he's an alcoholic to protect his reputation. No one gives a good, sweet Jesus about your reputation, Mr. Alcoholic. You know, you got a lot of work to do before anybody cares about your reputation. It's about AA's reputation. That's why they put that provision. It's not a deal breaker. You're not going to get thrown out of AA. It's an extremely loose organization, for starters. There is no national necessarily any national leadership council of AA. They've got a books that they sell. They have publications that they sell. But AA is loosely affiliated with these individual groups. But the point I'm making here is the reason why they call it Alcoholics Anonymous is they don't want anybody going out into the world and saying, I'm an alcoholic, I go to AA, yeah? Because when a guy says, I'm a recovering alcoholic, the next question is, do you go to AA? And it could very well be, maybe it's a 50% chance that, yeah, I do. Well, what happened there then is the following thing. When that guy falls off the wagon, if that's what you want to call it, and let's just call it what they call it in AA is a slip, which actually sounds kinder. That guy starts drinking. Guess who the average person is going to blame? They're going to blame AA because that guy not working the program, maybe not going to meetings, whatever it was he was doing, it ain't working. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous has been around since the 30s. It is regarded by some as the most successful drug treatment program in history. I think that that's a fair statement. I would like to know any other program that has treated, if you want to call it that, drug addicts or alcoholics as successfully as Alcoholics Anonymous. It was an organization that was formed out of desperation. It was the desperate move of a man by the name of Bill W., Bill Wilson, who was going to go back to drinking. He was going to go back to drinking, which because he had had some horrifying bouts with drinking, DTs, sickness. He'd been in and out of hospitals. He felt that he was on his way back to taking a drink. He was out of town. I think he was in Cleveland. He had to do something, and he got the name of a hospital where they treated alcoholics, and he went to that hospital and asked one of the doctors, can I talk to one of these men? And doctor's like, why? He said, because it's going to help me. It's going to help me not drink. Now, I know this story because I was in Al-Anon myself in the 70s. I had two friends that were alcoholics. Now, here's the thing. When you go out there and you say, I'm in AA, people go, oh, wow. And when they see you take a drink, it is the feeling of Alcoholics Anonymous with the feeling of Bill W. and those that contributed to what they call the Big Book, that now you've just, you know, basically told everybody that AA doesn't work. And we know that it does. Millions and millions and millions of people have been helped. But when you go out there and start telling everybody about your affiliation with AA, then guess what happens? You wind up reflecting poorly on the organization if you go out and take a drink. Better not to say anything at all. Just shut up. Okay? What is it? I'm a recovering alcoholic. Who cares, man? Do you think that it means anything? Even if you were the most successful recovering alcoholic in the history of the world, you saying you're a recovering alcoholic, the likelihood of that helping someone more than the giddy thrill you get out of the ego trip of telling everybody that is very slim, in my opinion. That's just me. You know, you want to help another alcoholic, there's ways of doing it, and you can do it in AA, you can do it the way Bill W. did it, you can do it one-on-one, but getting on TV or whatever the hell it is they want to do, hi, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and then you turn around and you have, I remember Dick Van Dyke, a whole big movie about Dick Van Dyke had the DTs, and he was an alcoholic, he was a drunk, and, you know, he made the movie about himself. And the fact that he went to AA, and they finally asked him, are you drinking now? And he says, I drink wine occasionally. Now, that's not a recovering alcoholic. What Dick Van Dyke basically admitted to was that he slipped. He's not a recovering alcoholic. He's back to drinking. I don't know what happened to Dick Van Dyke in his life. I don't know where he is or what he's doing. I don't even know if the guy's still alive. But I can tell you that what he admitted to there was a terrible thing. And it reflected poorly, again, on a group like AA, because now they're saying, I thought you're not supposed to drink if you're an AA. According to Dick Van Dyke, he can drink a little white wine or a little light wine or a little, you know, a little something. The world famous Phil Henry Show. I do appreciate you hanging with me tonight, folks, on this Monday night. Back tomorrow night, Bud Dickman, Robert Leonard, and you here on the world famous Phil Henry Show. And don't forget to visit us online at philhenryshow.com. where you can get our backstage pass and access to all of the marvelous archives that we have got. Until tonight at 10, let that be a lesson to you. Good night. So you were there all that time.
Phil Hendry.